Take your Bibles, turn to Numbers chapter 1. Numbers chapter 1. What a day that will be when my Jesus I shall see. We tend to look forward to heaven to get out of this world, which is fine. That's a good motive. But really, the best motive is to go see Jesus. There's a crown for those who love his appearing. Now, most of us look forward to heaven because we loathe this world. So you don't get crowns for that. The reward is just getting to heaven. That's good. But if you want a crown, we've got to love his appearing. And it is going to be quite the appearing. Numbers chapter 1, we are in the military law portion of our study. We've gone through religious law, business law, criminal law, family law, dietary and hygiene law. And now we're going to talk briefly about military law. Remember when God brought the Israelites out of Egypt, he got them out using nature to inflict the Egyptians with all these plagues. They got through the Red Sea, they get into the wilderness, and they're at the foot of Mount Sinai, and they make a covenant with God, or God presents a covenant to them that essentially meant if they would obey him and serve him, then he would fight for them, he would love them, take care of them, call them his people, and bless them. And when he did that, he hinted at war. Now, war is not something the children of Israel had ever been experienced in. God called Abraham out of Ur. Abraham had Isaac. Isaac had Jacob. Jacob had the 12 sons, Joseph being one of them, and coming to Egypt. At this point, though, they're not very well, as a nation now, experienced in war. Abraham was a skilled warrior, even though we see Abraham as more of a businessman. He was a warrior. He saved Lot with his 400 armed and trained servants. Jacob's sons, Isaac, I don't recall of any battles. Jacob, I don't recall any battles. He was a schemer. He would get out of conflict. But a few of Jacob's sons beat up on Shechem and that city that took Dinah, their sister. Outside of that, the children of Israel were not given to war. When they come into Egypt, they're shepherds. They're dealing with flocks and herds. For 430 years, they're in the land of Egypt as servants. They're slaves. There's certainly no battle going on. So when God brings them out, you're talking 4 to 5 to 6 centuries without any true military background. And when God makes a covenant with them, I want you to hear some of the words that God uses. He hints at war, and they should have picked up on that and maybe not been concerned, but it should have opened their eyes to, what's that going to look like? But he said in verse 20 of Exodus 23, you just listen here because you're in Numbers chapter 1. He says to them, I'm going to send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. He said, my angel will go before you and bring you in unto the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. And God says, I will cut them off. They can go along with that because they just saw what he did to Egypt. And then he says in verse 27 of that chapter, I will send my fear before thee and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come, and I will make all thine enemies turn their backs unto thee. Now, to have an enemy turn their back unto you, you've got to see them. You've got to be engaged with them. So for them, they should have thought, turn their backs unto us, enemies here. I wonder what that means. That means probably some conflict. He says, I will send hornets before you, which will drive them out. I will not drive them out, though, in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. He said, by little and little I will drive them out from before thee. Little by little. You know what that is? That's a sustained period of war that the children of Israel were about to engage in. So they left Egypt as slaves. They're liberated. They're delivered. God says, I'm going to send you into the promised land now with all these enemies. I'm going to send my angel before you. He's going to be like a hornet. We're going to chase all these people out of the land, but I'm going to do it little by little. They're going to turn their backs on you. They're going to run from you. That is a hint at war. Moses, when they left Egypt, he understood God's nature. He understood that God was given to war in some regards. He said in his song after getting through the Red Sea, he says, the Lord is a man of war. the Lord is his name. Moses understood what maybe the people didn't, but that was the fact that as much as God wants peace, he knows that peace often comes at a cost. Comes at a cost. Peace is very rarely, if ever, brought in with negotiation. There is always some type of compromise or inevitably some type of battle that ensues that forces a party to come to the table. Peace, as much as people want to wave the flag of peace and we don't want war, war is inevitable on a cursed planet, where people are proud and where people are covetous and where people are depraved. People do terrible things. We fight over everything. War is inevitable in this world. There can be no peace without it. Before we can have peace, you have to remove that which hinders peace. Now, Jesus Christ is a perfect example. He is referred to in Scripture as the Prince of Peace. Well, he can't establish peace without himself dying. You know, if he could, he would have came and said, peace, and peace be unto you, world. Oh, yay, we're happy now. No, he had to die for sin so that we can now have peace with God. Get rid of that sin. For peace, there needs to be some type of sacrifice, typically. And Israel had war in its future. There could be no peace within the nation if they had neighboring hostile enemies. And it was going to be a sustained period of war in the Promised Land. And because Israel would inherit the hatred of the world, no nation has been more hated than the nation of Israel from its inception, and it will continue to be hated until the end of time. God knew the nation of Israel would be at constant war. I don't know if you know this, but the Israeli military is one of the greatest in the world. It is one of the smallest nations in the world, but it is one of the most elite forces. We have a very close alliance with Israel, our military and their military. We share a lot of the technology. Their intelligence is superior. When we were over in Israel, the director and the tour guide, as well as an Air Force, retired Air Force pilot who was on tour with us, all said multiple times throughout the trip, you have nothing to worry about here. You can't see them, but there are Israeli military everywhere. At one point, we were up in at Megiddo, and there's a highway down the Valley of Jezreel, and they said, just so you know, there's underground runways under some of the highways here. They'll have planes take off out of nowhere underneath the ground. They can convert that whole nation into essentially a battlefield without any effort. They're very proud of their military over there because they're surrounded. Unlike America, who has water, friendly nation, they're surrounded by people who hate them. And so they have a very extensive military. This has been because they're hated. And God knew this from the beginning. And so he prepared them for war. So let's look at just a few things that are written into the law pertaining to war. Let's look at the ability for war. In other words, what requirements they had to have to serve. It says in verse 2 of Numbers chapter 1, this is pertaining to a census that they were going to be taking under the direction of God. And God told Moses in verse 2, take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel after their families by the house of their fathers with the number of their names, every male by their polls. Verse 3, from 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel, thou and Aaron shall number them by their armies. So when God implemented Judaism and gave Moses the law, he included in that law the requirements to serve in the military. For us in America, I'm pretty sure it's 18 and older. You can enlist. In many cases in our history, there was drafting going on. In Israel at the time of Moses, a 20-year-old male who was able to go to war. So that would eliminate certain handicaps. We're not talking about peanut allergies. We're not talking about the things that maybe our military takes into account today. But we're talking about whatever would enable them to go into war, be able to throw a spear, hold a sword, hold a stick, whatever would allow them to go in. That's the only thing they needed to have was the ability to go, and they had to be 20 years or older, which is interesting because I think universally around the world now, we view 18 years of age as the age of maturity, and you can serve and get all these extra benefits and whatnot. But under Moses, it was 20 years of age. The IDF, or the Israel Defense Forces, they do not follow the law of Moses today, as you can imagine, they have a requirement for all Israeli citizens to serve in the IDF. So if you're a male growing up in Israel, you're a citizen, you have to serve for 32 months. It's a requirement. If you're a woman, you have to serve in the Israeli military defense. I don't know if you knew that. Now, your term is 24 months, so they serve less time. But when we were in Israel, you see IDF members all the time. They're everywhere because it's a requirement in that nation. You have to serve in it. And that's why I have told those of you who are interested in going, security is not a problem, really. It's not a problem having been there and seeing the presence of the military. There just isn't a problem. Now, that being said, we asked Mark, the director of some certain areas of the country, and he said, well, we're not going to take you there. Evidently, there are some other hot spots. He says the only time we go there is in an armored bus. So they keep you away from the Gaza Strip in particular. So we have a law here that's not being observed today, but back in the day, it was 20 years old and upward. Males, not females, and you had to be able to handle the physical requirements of war. Look at Numbers chapter 10, and you'll see there's a specific alarm for war in Moses' law. There was a specific alarm, and this was to be observed carefully. This should not be looked down upon or overlooked as a small, minor detail. This is actually a big deal for God, and I'll try to explain why. Verse 1, Numbers chapter 10, and the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, make thee two trumpets of silver. Of a whole piece shalt thou make them, that thou mayest use them for the calling of the assembly and for the journeyings of the camps. And when they shall blow with them, all the assembly shall assemble themselves to thee at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. So they didn't have an app back then, or a texting chain, or an email chain, or a phone chain. When it was time to be assembled for any reason, announcements, they would blow with these two silver trumpets, and people would gather at the door of the tabernacle. They would have specific calls for different things. If you read through this chapter, a certain number of blowing of the trumpet, the north or the south parts of the camp would start to journey. So they were used for a variety of things. But you look at verse number 8, and the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow with the trumpets, and they shall be to you for an ordinance forever throughout your generations. And in verse 9, God tells Moses, and if ye go to war in your land against the enemy that oppresseth you, then ye shall blow an alarm with the trumpets. And look what it says, and ye shall be remembered before the Lord your God, and ye shall be saved from your enemies. I believe that last phrase, the last two phrases, be remembered before God and be saved from your enemies, belong with the trumpets. In other words, I don't think God's saying, all right, blow an alarm, and then you go out to war, and you're going to be remembered every war you fight, and you'll be delivered from every enemy you fight. I don't think these are independent of the trumpets. I think they're connected to that. The reason I say that is because if you have a rogue part of your military who is very passionate about fighting, and maybe they have a lot of national pride, and they don't like what the neighboring Hittites are doing, and they go off on their own and fight a battle, they can't go out and say, God's going to remember us, and God's going to deliver us from our enemies, just because they're the chosen people. You see, the trumpets are what the military, the entire rank of the military, is supposed to wait to hear, because the trumpets are being blown by who? Not the military commanders, not the captains, the generals, the lieutenants. The trumpets are being blown by the priests. You say, so what? Well, the priests should be getting their information about war from God. In other words, we take our orders from God, not from the military or from our intelligence agencies. We take our orders from God. And if we wait till God says go, that means God's remembering us and will deliver us. Now there's an element of faith to it. The trumpets were to make the military wait on God, not on intelligence or on military strategy or passion or courage. It was to wait on God. In Israel, under Moses, I don't certainly speak for the present country, but under Moses, there was no separation between what we would call the church and the state. They were one and the same. In fact, the state operated under the direction of what we would think of as the church. What God said to do, the state would follow. These trumpets were overseen by the priests, which gave them direction from God, which made them be patient in time of uncertainty, sober in time of oppression, and ultimately faithful in time of war. It would allow them to wait on God, to follow God, and to trust God. So these trumpets were a big deal. They had to wait for the Lord to give them approval. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 20. Deuteronomy chapter 20, in the law, there is provision pertaining to an assembly before war. Now, the law that we know of takes a lot of heat, doesn't it, for being harsh and unforgiving? And in some ways, it's very understandable, at least when you compare the law to our present culture and society. But this military provision should open some eyes. Not just the assembly leading up to war, but what is allowed to happen at the assembly. Verse number one, now Deuteronomy, remember, is the second giving of the law. So a lot of what we're going to look at is not in the first giving of the law because they were in the wilderness. Deuteronomy is just before they're going into the promised land, 40 years after the deliverance from Egypt, and they know they're going to be engaged in a lot of battling. So that's why there is some more provision here. Verse 1, when thou goest out to battle against thine enemies and seest horses and chariots and a people more than thou, be not afraid of them. For the Lord thy God is with thee, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be, when ye are come nigh unto the battle, that the priest shall approach and speak unto the people, and shall say unto them, Hear, O Israel, ye approach this day unto battle against your enemies. Let not your hearts faint. Fear not, and do not tremble, neither be ye terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goeth with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you. That should remind you, by the way, of Exodus chapter 23, that covenant I referred to earlier about God sending his angel before them. Now, after the priests say that, the officers in verse 5 shall then speak to the people. And this is what they say. What man is there that hath built a new house and hath not dedicated it? Let him go and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it. Verse 6, and what man is he that planted a vineyard and hath not yet eaten of it? Let him also go and return into his house, lest he die in the battle and another man eat of it. So if you don't want to go to battle, you would constantly be planting vineyards. Well, I've got another one, another patch of vineyards. Verse number 7, and what man is there that hath betrothed a wife and hath not taken her? Let him go and return into his house, lest he die in the battle and another man take her. And then in verse 8, God tells Moses that the officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say this, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. And after that it shall be, when the officers have made an end of speaking unto the people, that they shall make captains of the armies to lead the people. This is a very interesting provision for the military. You would think under a law that is as strict and rigid as the Mosaic law, that there'd be no tolerance for any potential deserters, any tolerance for soldiers who want to go home and take care of their families, take care of their structures, take care of their vineyards. You would think that it's fight and to the death. Not under God's law. This idea that God says, listen, if you've got a wife at home that you've not yet married, go. Don't fight a battle where you may die and leave her to another man. If you just built a house and you haven't yet dedicated it, hey, go home. Dedicate your house, start your home with your family well, we'll fight the battle. If you planted a vineyard, you've been working hard to take care of your kids and your wife, go home, take care of that vineyard, we'll fight this battle. It's a very interesting provision for me to think about in light of everything else we know about Judaism. What does this tell us? It tells us that the military, in God's eyes, should never be more important than the home. This tells us that your career, whether it's military or not, should never be more important than your wife, your children, and taking care of your home. This shows how much God values the family unit. This shows you that God can fight a battle with other guys if you've got more important things at home. Very, very intriguing concept with what God is allowing here. But for me, the most impressive element is that final provision. There were three things that you could leave the battlefield for. You could leave for your home, for your wife, for your vineyard. The fourth one, though, wow. Hey, anybody here faint-hearted? Anybody afraid of the horses, the chariots, and the massive armies you're about to face? Anybody afraid? If you're afraid, just head on home. No desertion charges. You won't be punished. We won't pick on you. We won't picket your home. We won't declare you a moron. We're going to let you go home. That would be me, probably. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we don't want any fearful people here. So just go home. He's not accusing them. He's not criticizing them. He's not condemning them. He's not punishing them. He's not putting them in prison. He's not forcing them to be courageous. He says, if anybody's afraid, it's all right. Just go home. You know what God is doing here? He's allowing the fearful to avoid the battle so that the courageous don't get infected with fear. This shows you how infectious and contagious fear is and how seriously God takes it. Now, this plays right into my campaign against fear around here. I have been beating the drum against the spirit of fear because it has become, as I have said, in many ways, an epidemic in our churches. We have proclaimed fear in some ways a virtue, and we're afraid of everything, and so we've become a very fearful people. Why? Fear is contagious. I can go on the internet now and type in something, some crazy thing about what's going to happen if you keep drinking the water in the town of Elma, and I can make up something, and you'll have the whole town terrified. Fear is contagious. It's not difficult to terrify people. God knows this. That's why he says, he hath not given us a spirit of fear. The spirit of fear comes from the adversary who knows he can cripple and paralyze and infect us with it. God instead desires to give us a spirit of power. And God says, rather than to the fearful soldiers, rather than say, be courageous and fight for me, he says, if you're afraid, don't waste your time on this one. Go home. I'd rather fight with a few courageous people than with a whole army full of courageous and fearful people. Because, he says, look at it again in verse number 8. At the end, he says, if you're fearful and faint-hearted, let him go and return into his own house, lest his brethren's heart faint as well as his heart. He doesn't want any fear on the battle. And so if you're afraid, you're a liability to us. That's what he was saying. If your mind is somewhere else, if it's at home with your wife, then go home. If your mind is with your vineyard, go home. If your mind is on your house, go home. If your mind is afraid of dying, then you're of no use to us. In fact, you're a vulnerability. You're a liability. You can go home. God is saying, I don't need you to do this. I can do this. I just need you to trust me. I need you to embrace the spirit of power. That was his mindset with his military. Pretty impressive approach. I like the way God handled that. He knows what he's doing. All right, turn to chapter... Are you in chapter 20? Where are you? No, you're in chapter 10. Turn it. Oh, you are chapter 20. Where am I? Oh, there's the paper. All right, stay in chapter 20. Let's talk about the action before war. Verse number 10, another, I think, minor detail that probably many of us have never seen before. And it says in verse 10 of chapter 20, when thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee answer of peace and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee. Interesting, right? We just assume that God is in the business of wiping people out that don't agree with him or with the children of Israel. But that is not the case here. God is not interested in the destruction of anyone for any reason, truthfully. That's why the Bible tells us in 2 Peter 3:9 that the Lord is not willing that any should perish. You know, God is not a warmonger. God is not interested in war for the sake of war. God is not interested in any life losing its life for any reason. However, as I said earlier, war is unavoidable where there is evil. Loss and heartbreak are unavoidable where there is a curse. But before the Israelite military waged war against the city, they would knock on the gate and say, "We are here to offer you peace." Granted, that peace will come with a sacrifice. You will lose your sovereignty, and we will become your commanding people, and you will be servants to us. But we will not hurt you. We will not destroy you. That was the direct order from God. God is a very peaceful God. Verse number 12, this is where it gets a little more difficult and a little more interesting. Let's talk about the agenda for war. Verse 12, "And if it will make no peace with thee, but chooses to make war against thee," number one, thou shalt besiege it. That's your first thing. He's telling them what to do. The Israeli military, they're going to have liberties to do it how they want, but they've got to, number one, besiege it. They're not to try to knock the walls down. That's God's business. He did that with Jericho. Besiege it. Keep it contained. Verse 13, "And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thine hands, then," number two, "thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword." Now, remember Jericho. Jericho is crucial in showing this to work. Jericho would come after this law. Deuteronomy was the giving of the second law. Joshua, they come into the promised land. They go right to Jericho. It's the first city they face. They besiege it. And God says, when the Lord delivers it into thine hand, who brought the walls down? God brought the walls down. Once that happens, every male should be killed. Verse 14. "But the women and the little ones and the cattle and all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, shalt thou take unto thyself, and thou shalt eat the spoil of thine enemies, which the Lord thy God hath given thee." So number one, besiege. Number two, because they didn't want peace, they want to fight you, they're your enemies. You can't cohabit the land with your enemies. They're going to always be your enemies. Sure to kill all the males. Then you can take the women, the children, the cattle, and all the spoil, the possessions for yourself. And in verse 15, "Thus shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations." So that's going to be the long-term military strategy that God put into place. However, the short-term military strategy is not as comforting if you're a Hittite, Perizzite, and so on and so forth. Look at verse 16. "But of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth, but thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee." You say, why would God be so unforgiving to these nations? Verse 18, "that they teach you not to do after all their abominations, which they have done unto their gods, so should ye sin against the Lord your God." God was willing to let them enslave other political cities to them that weren't in the immediate promised land, but the promised land was God giving that to them, and they were not to cohabitate with the heathen. God wanted them all destroyed strictly because God didn't want his people to eventually learn those things, and then God would have to destroy them. We cannot forget, as much as we're trying to be peace-loving people here in America and we're trying to police the world with kindness, the reality is God doesn't see it the way America sees it. God sees the world through his holy eyes. And if you've turned entirely over to idolatry and you've rejected him, he's the creator, he's the God, he can do what he wants. And if you reject God, you become God's enemy. You don't want to be a God's enemy. God can then wipe you out and be justified to do that. Every person, everything in that area. And that's what's happening here. Now, turn over to Numbers chapter 31. So that's the agenda for war. Besiege it, kill the men, take the women, children, cattle, and spoil. That would require some conversion. I hope you understand that. They would need to be converting those pagans to Judaism. That's the long-term agenda. I've got you in Numbers 31 because this is a historical battle that takes place prior to the Promised Land. And there's some wording here that makes me think that this becomes precedent moving forward, although it can be confirmed nowhere in the law. But I want to read it. Verse number 1, God tells Moses in verse 2 then, avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. We're talking about avenging God. We're talking about vengeance at the hand of God. We're not talking about going in and conquering land and taking it for yourself. This is a justice. God is using the nation of Israel to judge the Midianites. And so in verse 6, Moses sends the people to war, 1,000 of every tribe, them and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, to the war with the holy instruments and, interesting, the trumpets to blow in his hand. We talked about that. Verse 21, Eleazar the priest says unto the men of war which went to the battle, remember the assembly before the battle, the priest is addressing the men, and here's the wording. This is the ordinance of the law which the Lord commanded Moses. That wording makes me think that there is a law, not recorded in Scripture, that they're to handle the battle a certain way. Now, maybe it was just that specific battle. We don't know. But I wanted you to see it. Verse 22, only the gold and the silver, the brass, the iron, the tin, and the lead, everything that may abide the fire, ye shall make it go through the fire, and it shall be clean. Nevertheless, it shall be purified with the water of separation. Can I stop right there? Does anyone remember what the water of separation was? Nancy? Very good. Yes. So it has to be put through the fire, purged, and it still needs the water of separation. That's the ashes of the red heifer with the clean water outside the camp. They need to wash all the precious metals from war. Well done, Nancy. If I was handing out bonus points, you would get some. All right. And it says at the end of verse 23, and all that abideth not the fire, ye shall make go through the water. So that would be pertaining to non-precious metals, wood, things that you can't put in the fire without them being consumed. You still have to wash them with the water of separation. Verse 24, and ye shall wash your clothes on the seventh day, and ye shall be clean, and afterward ye shall come into the camp. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, take the sum of the prey that was taken, both of man and of beast, thou and Eleazar the priest, and the chief fathers of the congregation. And then all that stuff, divide it into two parts between two parties. Number one, them that took the war upon them, who went out to battle. And then number two, between all the congregation. And levy a tribute unto the Lord of the men of war which went out to battle. Here's the levy. It's a tax, if you would. All the spoil for the soldiers. One soul of 500, both of the persons and of the beeves and of the asses and of the sheep. So that's for every 500 people or animals that a soldier got, one was to go to the Lord. And in verse 29, give it unto Eleazar the priest for a heave offering unto the Lord. Then in verse 30, here is the children of Israel's half, the congregation. It'll be one portion of 50 of the persons, of the beeves, of the asses, and of the flocks, of all manner of beasts, and give them unto the Levites, which keep the charge of the tabernacle of the Lord. So if you're a soldier, you have a specific levy. It's one per 500. You bring it and you offer it to God. It's a heave offering. If you're just a member of the congregation, you didn't serve, you're one of those guys that went back to your wife, to your house, to your vineyard, one of those guys that was afraid. You're the people back that are, you know, taking care of the wounded. You're taking care of everything back at home. You're going to get something as well. And then you have to give one of every 50 to the priesthood. It's a tax if you want to look at it that way. We don't know if that was the standard procedure. I think it probably was. Because when the children of Israel go into the Promised Land, they get most of their possessions. Because remember, they're wandering. They're wandering in the wilderness. They cannot accrue possessions. They cannot build their houses. They cannot earn their fortunes. When they come into the Promised Land, God is going to rob the inhabitants and give that to the Israelites to have their houses, their furniture, their jewelry, their money, their food. All of that's going to come from them. So I think that that's how it gets transferred to all the congregation. Soldiers get as much as they want, they get half, I should say. They get as much as they want in the battle. They get half. The congregation gets half. Of the soldiers, 1 out of 500 goes to God to thank him for the victory. 1 out of 50 from the Israelites go to the priesthood, who, remember, don't have a job. It is their job to take care of the people. Their income, their food, everything comes from the people. So now you're supplying needs for all the people, soldiers, families, and the priesthood through battles. And the temple would be built under Solomon with all the precious metals that are accrued in the battles. David had dedicated a lot of these things to the building of the temple, as did other kings. So I think this probably ended up being standard procedure, although we can't prove that anywhere in the book of Deuteronomy in particular. I just think that happened to play a role in it. That's why I wanted to share it with you. All right, there's just three short things we'll have to wait till next week to look at pertaining to war left in the law. Any questions about the first five things we looked at today? Wartime, the military, for the children of Israel under Moses. Tom. Says the father of a Marine. Yes, sir. Well applied. I don't know the wording. We'll have to look at it after class. But remember when Jesus talks about if you've not left father and mother and all those things? It seems to me like at some point he refers to houses, and I'd be really curious if he refers to vineyards as well. Because in the Gospels, Jesus did say, hey, if you're going to be my disciple, you've got to love me more than your father, mother, husband, wife, children. He does want... So I will go back to Israel fighting battles. The home is more important than the military. When you get to the New Testament, the home is still elevated very high, but it's not elevated above service to God. Now, don't confuse that with ministry in the church, but service to God. God must be first. God will not share his position of number one with anybody, a false god or a person you love. If you put your child ahead of God, you're not putting your child in a good place. If you put your spouse ahead of God, you're not putting your spouse in a good place. If you put your house above God, trouble will happen. If you put your vineyards before God, troubles will happen. So absolutely, the applications are very similar. And going back to what we did talk about, God will fight the battles. We've just got to make sure he's first. We've got to trust him with those things. And there's no one better to trust God with than our loved ones, than our spouses, children, siblings, so on and so forth. So, yes, very good observation, Tom. Any other questions before we dismiss? Jeffrey.
Just a comment on Israel's advanced military that you mentioned at the beginning. They're also one of the top countries for cybersecurity, which is becoming more and more prevalent as we hear in the news. They're like one of the top three countries making advances in that, which is interesting to think about. Yeah. Those implications as well.
Yeah, God has still his hand on his people. I hope we all realize that. They're still his people. They've rejected him. And God has moved on to the Gentile to provoke the Israelites to jealousy. But they're still his people. The covenant still applies. Genesis chapter 12. If you bless them, he'll bless you. If you curse them, he'll curse you. Which is why we should support politicians who support Israel. And fortunately, we have one right now. So keep praying for our president. But God, I believe, has given the Jewish people favor when it comes to protecting themselves. When it comes to the military, in this case, cybersecurity. I mean, I'm in touch with Mark and his group, Jewish Awareness, and they just sent out something, it was probably 2 months ago, but the Israelites uncovered, the Hebrew people uncovered this massive storage house of documentation in Iran about what they're trying to do with nuclear weapons and what they're trying to do in particular to the nation of Israel. And it makes those who hate Israel look ridiculous, in particular the Western leaders who assume Iran is just a wonderful friend of ours and an ally of Israel. The Israelites have learned not to trust anybody, and they do it on their own, and they're very, very intelligent. So yes, Jeff would know in those circles, also the brother of a Ranger. So any other comments before we wrap up? Perfect. Let's go ahead and close in prayer, and we'll meet back here the next hour. I'm going to ask Jesse Fazio, would you please close in prayer?